Last week, James Hansen, who used to be the lead climate scientist for NASA, and 16 of his co-authors came out with a new report about the rate at which the Arctic ice caps and the glaciers are melting, saying that the rate is much faster than previously believed and could result in our sea levels rising 10 feet in as little as 50 years. Now, here in the St. Louis area, we're not all that concerned about sea level rise. After all, if they rise enough, we'll eventually have oceanfront property. But for the major cities around the world that are on the coasts of our country and every other country, this could be really, really, really bad news. Here to analyze that report and talk about what our future may hold is a climatologist and distinguished professor of meteorology at Penn State University, Michael Mann. Michael, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Paul. It's good to be with you.
Last time you and I talked was when your book came out. It's called The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, about dispatches from the front lines of trying to talk about climate science in our politically charged world. Now we have this report from James Hansen, one of the most respected people in the field. You've had a chance to see it. What do you take from it?
Yeah, well, I do think it's an important report. Now, there's a very important caveat as well, however, which is that the article hasn't actually gone through scientific peer review yet. It's a somewhat unusual approach to publishing that the authors used. They published the paper in what's known as an open access, open review journal, which means the paper's posted online. The reviewers post their comments online. The authors reply to them, and you actually watch the peer review process play out in public. It's an increasingly more widespread approach to publishing. Many scientists consider it as a way of providing greater transparency into the entire sort of process of scientific publication. But it is important to understand that that means that the article hasn't yet been vetted in the way that a normal, you know, peer-reviewed journal article would have been vetted by the time it's publicized.
Okay. So
it's a little unusual in that sense. But, you know, James Hansen has a remarkable track record. He's shown himself to be remarkably prescient about climate change. He was the first scientist to speak out publicly about the notion that climate change had already arrived back in the late 1980s, before most scientists were willing to say that we could detect the human impact on climate. Hansen was out there saying, hey, it's here, and he was right. He made predictions about how much warming we would expect to see, given business-as-usual fossil fuel emissions, decades ago, and those predictions were remarkably accurate. They predicted the warming that we've actually seen. So there's reason to take them very seriously. When Hansen puts out a detailed article with many distinguished co-authors of this sort, we have to take it very seriously, and I have read it. I think that certainly with respect to the key take-home point that he makes, that sea level rise could proceed considerably more rapidly than many of the sort of previous studies, the studies highlighted in the previous report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, more sea level rise than many of these previous studies have argued. And he makes a reasonably plausible case for that. There are some details of the climate model simulation he performs that scientists, including myself, are sort of taking minor issue with aspects of the analysis, and we'll want to see that vetted. We'll want to see, you know, other scientists test some of the, you know, claims, address some of the claims that Hansen has made. But the take-home message that, you know, we could see quite a bit of sea level rise, even on a time frame of 50 years, I think Hansen is probably, again, right about that, that we may very well be currently underestimating just how fast that can unfold. And that's critical because our policies, the policies that we put in place to deal with climate change, how much we cut our current carbon emissions, and how quickly we transition away from a fossil fuel economy to a renewable energy economy, is going to determine just how far down we go, how far we go down this very treacherous road.
So are these predictions in Hansen's new report drastically different and more dire than what we had heard before?
They are. I mean, the assertion that we could see up to 3 meters, 10 feet or so of sea level rise within 50 years, that's a considerably more aggressive forecast than any other scientists have made. And again, he provides a plausibility argument to it. What he does is he looks sort of at the curve that describes how the melt of the ice sheets is increasing over time. And it's an upward curve. It's a concave upward curve, which means that it's accelerating over time. So rather than just being sort of a linear increase in melt from the ice sheets over time, he's arguing that we can actually see in the observations evidence of curvature that indicates it's getting faster over time. And it is that sort of prediction of an acceleration in the rate of melt from the Greenland ice sheet and the West Antarctic ice sheet upon which he bases this fairly dramatic and fairly alarming forecast of potential 10 feet of sea level rise, not 100 years from now, as some scientists have said, but 50 years from now. And that's a huge difference. Moving our infrastructure, retreating from our coastlines, from the major cities that are going to be subject to the effects of sea level rise, if we do that over a 100-year time scale, it's a whole lot easier than if we do that over 50. 50 years passes very quickly when you're trying to move New York City, Miami Beach, and the other major coastal cities of the world.
Yeah, I want to talk about the impact on those cities because, here in St. Louis, as I said, we're not on a coast, but we do know a little bit about rising waters. We had enough rain here in late May and most of June and early July that our rivers and particularly our streams were overflowing and flooding, not to the point where we were anywhere close to the 1993 flood, but plenty of people in this area do remember how much water that was in 1993 when areas like the Chesterfield Valley were overrun by the Missouri River and the Mississippi was over its banks, even in downtown St. Louis. And so we understand the impact of water damage. But what does 10 feet of water do to a city like New York or Miami or any place else in the world that is a coastal city?
Yeah, well, what it does is it takes a situation which right now is sometimes referred to as nuisance flooding. Miami Beach, every year now, the streets of Miami Beach flood due to a seasonal high tide known as the King Tide. That seasonal high tide didn't used to flood the streets of Miami when it arrived, and now it does. And that's the way sea level rise is going to encroach on our cities. Those nuisance floods are going to turn into catastrophic floods. And what today we call nuisance floods will be so common that it's no longer viable to maintain a city at that location. There'll be increased coastal erosion even before there's literally inundation by sea level rise. There's a certain amount of time we can buy through coastal defenses, building levees and beach nourishments, etc. But once you start talking about 3 meters, 4 meters, 5 meters of sea level rise, you're no longer in the realm of adaptation. You're in the realm of retreat. We're talking about retreating from our major coastal cities, and it's hard to even estimate the cost of that. We're talking about a substantial percent of global, gross domestic product of our economy would be sacrificed if we have to engage in that sort of mass movement away from our coastlines. And of course, it isn't just, we live in an increasingly global world, a global economy where, catastrophes in one location reverberate through the global marketplace. Extreme floods and droughts and wildfires in Europe sent global food prices skyrocketing a few years ago. There's the expression, no man is an island. Whether you live in an island or whether you live in the center of a continent, you're going to feel the negative impacts, even of that sea level rise and the damage it's doing to our economy. Meanwhile, in the center of the continents, where Missouri, Kansas, we're going to see increasingly severe and prolonged heat waves. The flooding you talked about, we do actually predict more frequent flooding. It seems like a contradiction, but what the models tell us is in many parts of the world, including large parts of the U.S., we could see an increase in flooding, but worse drought, worse summer drought. And what's going on there is that there's less rain during the summer, for example, and it's exacerbated by very warm soils evaporating moisture into the atmosphere, and that's what's giving us the drought. We're losing a lot of the moisture into the, because of very warm soils. But when it does rain, it literally pours or it floods because the atmosphere is warmer. When the conditions are conducive to the rising motion that gives us rainfall, you're going to be able to squeeze more moisture out of the atmosphere because a warmer atmosphere has more moisture in it. And so, ironically or seemingly paradoxically, we may very well see worse flooding and worse droughts over a large part of the central U.S., including Missouri, and anywhere you go. And I go around and I give public lectures about climate change around the country, around the world to some extent. And everywhere I go now, there is a story to tell about how climate change is impacting us negatively now where we live. It isn't this exotic, far-off problem with, the ice sheets and polar bears. It's hitting us where we live right now.
It's the Big 550 KTRS. Paul Harris talking with Michael Mann, one of our top climatologists and the author of The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars. Also wrote a book summing up the findings of the IPCC called Dire Predictions, Understanding Global Warming, which can walk you through all of these issues. But we're talking in particular about a new report from James Hansen, generally acclaimed as the top climatologist in the world, about the impact of climate change, and the report from Hansen that says that in the next 50 years it's going to be worse than we had previously predicted. So that all leads us to one question, Michael, which is, can we change the future?
We can. That's the good news. The good news is that while there is an urgency to acting now, unlike anything we've seen before, if we're going to avert catastrophic changes in our climate, then we really have no time to waste at this point. We really have to begin dramatically bringing down our carbon emissions, undergoing that transition to a renewable energy economy. It can be done. There are peer-reviewed articles that have demonstrated very clearly that we can do that without new technology. We have the technology now to do that. It's just a matter of investing in it, incentivizing it, leveling the playing field. The emission of carbon into the atmosphere is hurting the planet. You have to put some sort of price tag on that. You have to, whether you're talking about a carbon tax or emissions permits, somehow we have to internalize in the marketplace the damage that the burning of fossil fuels is doing to the planet. That will help us, that will help accelerate that transition to renewable energy, which is increasingly competitive even on its own. But once you level the playing field, we could really see that take off. And so ultimately, that's what we need to do. There is no time to waste, but we are going into a very critical summit. There's a climate change summit later this year in Paris, which will be the next round of international negotiations to put in place actionable targets and a treaty with broad sign-on from the leading nations of the world to do what is necessary to bring down our carbon emissions and transition to that renewable energy economy.
Well, everything you said there sounds like a good idea, but unfortunately our Congress doesn't work on good ideas. And considering the political reality of a country where the head of the Science Committee in the United States Senate doesn't know the difference between climate change and a snowball, it doesn't seem like we're going to be having any impact on that with our politicians leading the way anytime soon. And if the U.S. isn't going to be one of the people leading the way, right, how are you going to get the rest of the world in that conference in Paris in December to make a step forward or 10 steps forward or however many steps it's going to take?
Yeah, absolutely. And one, it is unfortunate that we see such intransigence right now in the U.S. Congress, both the House and the Senate, run by Republicans who not only aren't supportive in general of doing something about climate change, but in many cases simply deny that it's happening.
Yeah.
And that's not true. There's some really good Republicans on this issue, but unfortunately they're in the minority and there's pressure on them not to speak up. And so instead, that party, what we're hearing are the more shrill voices within that party, the voices of those who are basically acting as advocates for fossil fuel interests who were put in office by folks like the Koch brothers to oppose any agenda of acting on climate change. So what that means is that you know, we've sort of had to do an end run. And what we're seeing is at the executive level, President Obama has engaged in some historical actions, both in terms of the EPA's new the Clean Power Plan to put tight constraints on carbon emissions from coal-fired power plants, increased fuel efficiency standards, again, through the EPA, and this monumental treaty with China. So we now have the two largest emitters of carbon on the face of the planet, the U.S. and China, agreeing to make substantial cuts in their carbon emissions in the years and decades ahead. And China, by some measures, is already even ahead of schedule with respect to what they had promised. Some people say, well, you know, it's just words. You know, China isn't really going to act. And you know what? If you look at their coal emissions, they're actually going down even faster than they had agreed to in that treaty. So there are lots of reasons for cautious optimism. Yes, we have intransigence with the U.S. Congress, but there's action at the executive level. There's action at the international level. There's action at the municipal level. You've got great folks like Jerry Brown, governor of California, leading some very bold initiatives to help bring California to the forefront in leading on the transition to clean energy. And there's a consortium of the West Coast states now to price carbon. There's a consortium of the New England states. So you're sort of seeing a ground up, a groundswell, literally, of action from the ground up and at the highest level, at the executive level. We're missing that sort of, you know, what we'd like to see, which would be proactive climate and energy policy from the U.S. Congress. But even absent that, we're making a fair amount of progress. And, you know, ultimately, the other part of the solution is people got to vote. They've got to vote. They've got to put in place policymakers who will represent their interests, the preservation of the planet, rather than the short-term interests of fossil fuel front groups and lobbyists who have currently put in place a majority of people in the U.S. Senate and Congress to block action on climate change.
I got to tell you, Michael, considering how dire this Hansen report seemed to me when I read about it, you actually seem more optimistic now than you did when we first spoke a couple of years ago.
Well, you know, there are two tipping points that I think about very carefully that are always on my mind. The first is a very bad tipping point. It's the notion that if we warm the planet enough, we may set in motion things that we just can't stop. You know, the melting of the ice sheets, catastrophic climate changes. We're pretty close to that danger zone, and we don't exactly know where the cliff is, but we know we're nearing it. So there's that tipping point that we have to fear that we could cross if we don't act quickly. But the other tipping point, the one I hope for, is the tipping point in the public consciousness about this issue. And we've seen in recent years that the public consciousness on an issue can change very rapidly when things come together in the right way. And we've seen that on the issue of marriage equality, dramatic changes in policy that nobody could have imagined even 6 years ago, 7 years ago. So there very much is the potential that we can see that with climate change, especially with the moral leadership that the Pope Francis is displaying on this issue, where he's now come out and said, look, this is an issue of fundamentally of ethics and our ethical obligations to future generations and our stewardship to the planet, and we can no longer engage in the actions that are leading to the detriment of our climate and our planet. And that message seems to be catching. It got a lot of exposure when the Pope published his encyclical a couple months ago, and he's going to be back in the U.S. this fall, literally on tour in the U.S., leading the effort to promote the vision, you know, that provided in that encyclical, the vision, and really this moral and ethical issue of climate change that mm-hmm. we have to act on if we're going to not mortgage the planet for future generations.
Before I let you go, Michael, I want to go back to one thing you mentioned earlier, and that is the simple notion of migration. After all, once those cities on our coasts start being endangered by the sea level rise, the people who are there and the businesses that are there are going to have to move elsewhere, likely here to the interior, where you say we're going to have to worry about worse storms and droughts at the same time. So I'm curious about areas like around the Great Lakes, which are one of our largest stores of now of fresh water. And I would think that as there is more seawater, more salt water encroaching on land, the freshwater aspect of the Great Lakes is going to become even more important. Is that an area that you would expect people to start moving towards?
Well, you know, there are, freshwater bodies, fresh bodies of water like the Great Lakes that we currently rely on for water. There, more than that, we rely upon aquifers, ancient water that is, beneath the ground that we tap for our water resources. And those aquifers are slowly drying up. We're tapping them, and the real danger is that we start to exhaust the sources of fresh water that we have. Many of them are ancient. They've been there for millions of years. We're tapping them. There's no way to replenish them when they're gone. And in many regions, like the western U.S., like the Southwest in particular, where we're seeing record drought, we are seeing a collision. We're literally on a collision course where we've got increasing population in many of these centers at a time of diminishing water resources. Diminishing water resources because that population is, of course, tapping those resources, but also because climate change is leading to more widespread drought in many regions like the southwestern U.S. And so it isn't just the coastlines that people will ultimately be retreating from. We have what we call environmental refugeeism, literally what it sounds like, people fleeing their homeland because it's no longer viable for human existence. We're seeing that happen in the Sahel region of Africa. And one of the things that actually the national security community is terribly concerned about, for those who think that climate change is just an issue that, granola-crunching hippies care about, the U.S. national security community is terrified about climate change. It's what they call a risk multiplier. And the reason for that is that you're talking about a growing global population approaching potentially 9 billion by the middle of this century. Some demographers say maybe even 11 billion people by the end of the century. Mm. Increasing global population competing for diminishing water, food, and land because of the impacts of climate change and other human actions. That is a recipe for a conflict nightmare, and we're seeing some evidence of that. The Syrian uprising, many other conflicts around the world right now, which are really driven by conflicts, by competition for resources, be they food, water, or land. So ultimately, if we continue on this course, business as usual, burning of fossil fuels, and we allow climate change to quickly move into that dangerous territory, we're talking about a potentially a world that isn't that different from the world that Hollywood has envisioned in many of the post-apocalyptic films of recent decades. That is a possible future. That's not the future we want, and it is a future we can avoid, but we have to act now.
What a horrible future we would then be leaving to our children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren. And with rising sea levels and diminishing freshwater aquifers, it reminds me of the old saying, water, water everywhere and not a drop to drink.
Well, that's right, and water is just one dimension of this problem. We're talking about, what very well would be calamitous if we allow it to proceed. But the good news, and I want to stress that, is that, we are at a very, we're important juncture right now. We're really at the precipice. We have the time to act, but we have to act now, and that's why it is going to be so important to see progress made over the next year and hopefully coming out of the Paris summit later this year.
Michael Mann is a distinguished professor of meteorology and director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University and author of the book The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, Dispatches from the Front Lines. Thank you so much for your expertise today, Michael. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you, Paul. Always a pleasure to talk with you.
I'm Paul Harris. This is the Big 550 KTRS.